From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I have a hard time understanding how you separate out Roe. I understand why. If you say one thing, you upset my friends and colleagues on that side. If you say the other, you accept those of us on this side. But the people are entitled to know.
On day three of his confirmation hearing, Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito came under criticism for refusing to state whether he believes Roe v. Wade is settled law. Meanwhile, senators fought over Alito's membership in the Concerned Alumni of Princeton and whether the panel should subpoena records from the group that opposed the acceptance of blacks or women at Princeton.
We actually did get a letter, but...
You did get a letter, are you saying?
Well, now, wait a minute. You don't know what I got. I'm about
to... Of course I do, sir, Senator, since I sent it.
Well, the sender doesn't necessarily know what the recipient gets, Senator Kennedy.
And Republicans accuse the Democrats of distorting Alito's views.
Are you really a closet bigot?
I'm not any kind of a bigot.
No, sir, you're not.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito continued for a third day Wednesday. Alito's views on abortion remained a key point of debate. Democrats criticized Alito for not doing something that Chief Justice John Roberts did just 4 months ago during his confirmation hearings, state that Roe v. Wade is settled law. Alito's membership in the Concerned Alumni of Princeton, or CAP, also drew criticism. In 1985, in a job application to become an assistant attorney general, Alito noted he was a member of the group along with the Federalist Society. By 1985, the Concerned Alumni of Princeton was already a highly controversial group because it opposed equal educational opportunities for women, people of color, and the disabled. We'll play excerpts of the hearings just after headlines. This news on Iran: Russia, the U.S., the European Union, and China will reportedly hold talks next week on Iran's resumption of nuclear activities. The Iranian government has removed U.N. seals on its uranium enrichment equipment, sparking an outcry from the United States and Europe. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Iran's move did not violate international law, but may be brought before the U.N. Security Council. Meanwhile, Western leaders stepped up their rebukes of Iran. This is British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
I don't think there is any point in people or us hiding our deep dismay at what Iran has decided to do. And when taken in conjunction with their other comments about the state of Israel, they cause real and serious alarm right across the world.
Iran insists it's removed the seals to resume research activities and has no plans for uranium enrichment. This is former Iranian President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani.
They will regret creating any problems for us. God willing, we will get out of it successfully.
The former Iranian president, Rafsanjani. In Israel and the occupied territories, Israel's indicated it'll allow Palestinians in Jerusalem to vote in upcoming national Palestinian elections. Last month, Israel announced it would not allow Jerusalem's Palestinians to vote because of the participation of the Palestinian group Hamas. Meanwhile, doctors for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon say they'll be easing him off medication that's kept him in a medically induced coma since he suffered a stroke last week. And the Israeli government says it has suspended talks on a tourism project with evangelical leader Pat Robertson. This in response to Robertson's suggestion Ariel Sharon's stroke was divine punishment for pulling out of Gaza Strip. As Democracy Now! Reported last week, Robertson was heading a consortium in talks with the Israeli government to build a sprawling biblical theme park by the Sea of Galilee. Israel tourism spokesperson Ido Hartouf said Robertson's comments had offended many Israelis, but added, quote, "Evangelicals are the best friends of Israel, and they are very, very welcome here." In Brazil, a funeral service was conducted Wednesday for Lieutenant General Urano Teixeira da Mata Bacelar, the former commander of the UN force in Haiti. Lieutenant Bacelar was found dead in his Port-au-Prince hotel room Saturday with a gunshot wound to his head. UN officials are calling his death a suicide. He'd recently clashed with his UN superiors and Haitian business leaders over his opposition to a crackdown in the poor neighborhood of Cité Soleil. Meanwhile, the Brazilian ambassador, Paulo Cordeiro de Andrade Pinto, told the Associated Press Investigators want to probe other possibilities before confirming Basilar's death as a suicide. Pinto declined to say what those possibilities were. In other news, the bodies of 24 Haitian migrants have been found in the Dominican Republic in the last 2 days. The victims apparently died of suffocation while crossing the Haiti-Dominican border in a sealed truck. Immigration has been the source of considerable tension between the two countries for years. Last May, the Dominican government deported over 2,000 Haitians following the slaying of a Dominican woman. In Chile, former military dictator Augusto Pinochet was stripped of his legal immunity Wednesday, clearing the way for him to face charges he murdered political opponents in the 1973 coup that brought him to power. Chilean courts have previously stripped Pinochet's immunity for other cases, but he's avoided several trials by convincing judges he's medically unfit to stand trial. If the current case proceeds, it would reopen one of the most notorious human rights cases involving Pinochet's dictatorship, the so-called Caravan of Death, in which 75 jail dissidents were killed in the weeks immediately after the coup. In other news, the Associated Press is reporting former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay pressured the Bush administration to shut down an Indian-owned casino that lobbyist Jack Abramoff wanted closed shortly after a tribal client of Abramoff's donated money to DeLay's political activities. DeLay made the request just weeks after the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, then a client of Abramoff's, made a $1,000 donation to DeLay's Texans for a Republican majority. That committee's at the center of the campaign finance charges that forced DeLay to step down as House Majority Leader last September. Former Attorney General John Ashcroft declined to take action at the time. The Choctaw Indians tribe is among four tribes Abramoff admitted last week of defrauding out of millions of dollars. In California, a new $125 billion budget proposed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger includes spending cuts aimed mainly at welfare recipients. The proposed cuts to welfare programs would total almost $200 million over the next 2 years. A child care program for welfare recipients and work programs would be eliminated. The Los Angeles Times reports the savings the state would achieve from the cuts would do little to address the multi-billion dollar deficits that California still faces for the next several years. In South Carolina, five white teens have pleaded guilty to lynching a black teenager. The youths, all 17 and 18 years old, entered the pleas shortly before their trial was set to begin Tuesday. They were given sentences ranging from 2.5 to 6 years in prison. Their victim, 17-year-old Isaiah Clyburn, said through his lawyer that he forgave them. The five teens attacked Clyburn as he walked along a rural road in Cherokee County, South Carolina, on July 7th. According to prosecutors, the teens shouted racial slurs at Clyburn and beat him repeatedly as he tried to escape. In Miami, two Cuban Americans have been arrested on charges they spied in the United States for the Cuban government. Carlos and Elsa Alvarez, both of whom work at Florida International University, were jailed without bail on charges they conducted espionage for nearly 30 years. No evidence has emerged the couple spied on the U.S. government. Government sources say the couple's activities focused on Cuban exile groups who've worked to overthrow the government of Cuban President Fidel Castro. The Alvarezes will appear in federal court a week from today. Their attorneys indicate they'll plead not guilty. The Washington Post is reporting a high-ranking U.S. Army official has invoked his right not to incriminate himself while testifying in the military tribunal of two soldiers accused of using dogs to intimidate detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. The decision by Major General Jeffrey Miller, who helped set up interrogations at Abu Ghraib, comes shortly after Colonel Thomas Pappas, the commanding officer at Abu Ghraib, accepted immunity from prosecution this week and was ordered to testify at an upcoming military trial. According to the Post, Colonel Pappas could be asked how abusive tactics emerged, who ordered their use, and their possible connection to officials in Washington. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said, quote, "It's a stepping stone going up the chain of command, and that's positive. It might demonstrate it wasn't just a few rotten apples." And in Australia, six of the world's leading polluting countries announced a multi-million dollar fund to develop clean energy, but insisted they'll continue to rely on polluting fossil fuels to run their industries and economies. The United States, China, Japan, India, South Korea, and Australia which together account for nearly half the world's emissions of dangerous greenhouse gases, were holding the inaugural Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate. They form the group as an alternative to the Kyoto Protocol, which has set firm emissions targets. Representatives of the world's biggest mining and energy firms attended the talks. The final declaration said private corporations will be encouraged but not required to cut gas emissions. It also said fossil fuels, quote, will be an enduring reality for our lifetimes and beyond. This is U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman.
So I don't count this a change in policy. What this is a, if you will, a harnessing of the private sector. It is recognizing the fact that it is the private sector that makes the investment decisions. It is the private sector in all of these countries, not just the U.S., and all of the countries. It is the private sector that that develops the technology. It is the private sector that gains the benefits from those investments and is in a position to share.
U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman. Environmental groups slam the talks as a sham. This is Greenpeace Energy spokesperson Catherine Fitzpatrick.
Currently, the global business community and government spend $250 to $300 billion in subsidies to the fossil fuel sector. If we want to deal with climate change, we need to shift that sort of finance to clean energy.
Greenpeace spokesperson Catherine Fitzpatrick. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers. We turn now to the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. On Wednesday, during the third day of hearings, Alito's views on abortion remained a key point of debate. Democrats criticized Alito for not doing something that Chief Justice Roberts did just 4 months ago during his confirmation hearings, acknowledged that Roe v. Wade was the settled law of the land. Alito's membership in the Concerned Alumni of Princeton, or CAP, also drew criticism. In 1985, in a job application to become an assistant attorney general, Alito noted that he was a member of the group along with the Federalist Society. By 1985, the Concerned Alumni of Princeton were already a highly controversial group because the group was opposed to equal educational opportunities for women, minorities, and the disabled. On Tuesday, Alito claimed he had no memory of being involved in the organization, even though he mentioned the group on the job application at the Justice Department. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy asked Alito more questions about his connection to the group.
You have no memory of being a member. You graduated from Princeton in 1972, the same year CAP was founded. You call CAP a conservative alumni group. It also published a publication called Prospect, which includes articles by CAP members about the policies and the that the organization promoted. You're familiar with that?
I don't recall seeing the magazine. I
Did
might
you
have
know
seen
that
it
they
at some
had
point.
A magazine.
I've learned of that in recent weeks.
So a 1983 Prospect essay titled "In Defense of Elitism" stated, quote, "People nowadays just don't seem to know their place. Everywhere one turns, blacks and Hispanics are demanding jobs simply because they're black and Hispanic. The physically handicapped are trying to gain equal representation in professional sports, and homosexuals are demanding that government vouchsafe them the right to bear children." So, did you read that article?
Finish the last line.
Finish the last line is... And homosexuals are...
And now, here come women.
If the senator, let me just... can I get two more minutes from my friend? Just to continue along, I apologize, Judge. Did you read this article?
I feel confident that I didn't. I'm not familiar with the article, and I don't know the context in which those things were said, but they are... antithetical.
But could you think of any context that they could be
hard to imagine if that's what anybody was endorsing? I disagree with all of that. I would never endorse it. I never have endorsed it. Had I thought that that's what this organization stood for, I would never associate myself with it in any way.
The June 84 edition of Prospect magazine contains a short article on AIDS. I know that we've come a long way since then in our understanding of the disease, but even for that time, the insensitivity of statements in this article are breathtaking. It announces that a team of doctors has found that AIDS virus in the rhesus monkeys was similar to the virus occurring in human beings, and the article then goes on with this terrible statement. Now the scientists must find humans, or rather homosexuals, to submit themselves to experimental treatment. Perhaps the gay Princeton's Gay Alliance may want to hold an election. You didn't read that article.
I feel confident that I didn't, Senator, because I would not have anything to do with statements of that nature.
In 1973, a year after you graduated and during your first year at Yale Law School, former Senator Bill Bradley very publicly disassociated himself with CAP because of its right-wing views and unsupported allegations about the university. His letter of resignation was published in The Prospect, garnered much attention on campus and among the alumni. Were you aware at the time at the time that you listed the organization in your application?
I don't think I was aware of that until recent weeks when I was informed of it.
And in 1974, an alumni panel, including now Senator Frist, unanimously concluded that CAP had presented a distorted, narrow, hostile view of the university. Were you aware of that at the time of the job application?
I was not aware of it until very recently.
That was Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito being questioned by Senator Ted Kennedy. Kennedy later criticized Alito, telling reporters outside, quote, he can remember all 67 dissents in great detail, but he can't remember anything about this organization. Later, during the hearing, Kennedy got into a heated argument with the Senate Judiciary Chair, Arlen Specter, the Pennsylvania Republican, after Kennedy claimed the chair had failed to honor his request to subpoena records regarding the concerned alumni of Princeton.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have your attention, I think we ought to vote on issuing a subpoena to the custodian of those CAP records. And I want to do that at an appropriate time. I'd move that the committee go into executive session for the purpose of voting on the issuing of the sole purpose for issuing the subpoena of those records.
Well, we'll consider that, Senator Kennedy.
Well,
there are many requests which are coming to me in many quarters, and quite candidly, I view the requests, if it's really a matter of importance. You and I see each other all the time, and you've never mentioned it to me, and I do not ascribe a great deal of weight. We actually didn't get a letter, but...
You did get a letter, are you saying?
Well, now, wait a minute. You don't know what I got. I'm about to...
Of course I do, sir. Senator, since I sent it.
Well, the sender doesn't necessarily know what the recipient gets, Senator Kennedy.
I've got it right here.
You are not in the position to say what I receive. If you'll bear with me for just 1 minute.
But I am in a position to say what I sent to you on December 22nd.
Well, you're in a position to tell me what you sent.
I renew my request, Senator, and if I'm going to be denied, then I'd appeal the decision of the chair. I think we are entitled to this information. It deals with the fundamental issues of equality and discrimination. This nominee has indicated he has no objection to us seeing these issues. We've gone over the questions. And we are entitled to get that kind of information. And if you're going to rule it out of order, I want to have a vote on that here on our committee.
Well, don't be premature, Senator Kennedy. I'm not about to make a ruling on this state of the record. I hope you won't mind if I consider it. And I hope you won't mind if I give you the specifics that there was no letter which I received. I take umbrage that you're telling me what I received. I don't mind your telling me what you mailed, but there's a big difference between what's mailed and what's received, and you know that. We're going to move on now.
Well, Senator Grassley, Mr. Chairman, I'd appeal the ruling of the chair on this.
There's been no ruling of the chair, Senator.
Well, what
Kennedy.
Is the? My request is that we go into the executive session for the sole purpose of voting on a subpoena for these records that are held over at the Library of Congress for that purpose and that purpose only. And if I'm going to be denied that, I'd want to give notice to the chair that you're going to have it again and again and again, and we're going to have votes of this committee again and again and again until we have a resolution.
Senator Kennedy, I'm not concerned about your threats to have votes again, again, and again. And I'm the chairman of this committee, and I have heard your request, and I will consider it. And I'm not going to have you run this committee and decide when we're going to go into executive session. We're in the middle of a round of hearings. This is the first time you have personally called it to my attention, and this is the first time that I have focused on it. And I will consider it in due course.
That was Senate Judiciary Chair Arlen Specter responding to Senator Ted Kennedy. Later, Specter acknowledged his office had received the letter and that his staffers were obtaining the records for the committee without a subpoena. To discuss the significance of Alito's connection with concerned alumni of Princeton, as well as other issues, we'll be joined by a number of guests after break. This is Democracy Now!
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done.
The Weavers, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez to discuss the significance of Samuel Alito's connection with the concerned alumni of Princeton, as well as other issues raised during the Supreme Court confirmation hearings. We're joined by two guests. Jamin Raskin joins us in Washington, professor of constitutional law at American University School of Law, author of Overruling Democracy, The Supreme Court Versus the American People. And here in our Firehouse studio, we're joined by Ted Shaw, director, counsel, and president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. He is scheduled to testify at the Alito hearings tomorrow. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Ted Shaw. Your response first to the this whole discussion about the group Princeton alumni, the concerned alumni of Princeton, and the other key issues that your organization has considered after coming out against the nomination of Judge Alito to be a Supreme Court justice.
Well, thank you, Amy, and good morning to you. One of the things that was clear as the record developed yesterday during the hearings was that it's incredible to think that the nominee has no memory of this group. And what's interesting about it is he says he has no memory of being part of this group. On the other hand, if he was part of it, it was because of the ROTC concerns on the Princeton campus. This was a group that got a lot of attention. It was very controversial, as we heard in the lead-in. Bill Bradley distanced himself from this group. So it really strains credibility to think he has no memory. He put it down on his job application because it was significant to him, and it was significant because he thought that it would help him in positioning him with getting a job with the Reagan administration Justice Department. Now, I left the Justice Department in the early 80s because of the policies of the Reagan administration and civil rights. I was in the civil rights division. I remember the ideological climate at the time. And there were young, go-getter conservatives who would do anything to position themselves, but they were also true believers. I really don't think that this is the issue that the Legal Defense Fund would spend most of its time on. It's covered in our report. But it has emerged as a significant issue because it's a credibility issue. We're more concerned now with the record that Judge Alito has on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which indicates that, for the most part, his vote has not been in play on behalf of African Americans and women, other minorities, in discrimination cases. That's our concern. This is not a stealth candidate. This is somebody with a well-established record. We think his confirmation to the court will move the court significantly further in a direction in which it would be very, very difficult for African American, Latino, women, people who are disabled to win claims of discrimination because, for whatever reason, I can't peer into his mind, for whatever reason, he has a record of ruling in favor of defendants in these kinds of cases. So that's the basis on which we're opposing this nomination. This is a court that has been narrowly divided in race discrimination cases for 25 years, 5-4 decisions in almost every major case. So we believe that his confirmation will move the court much further to the right because Justice O'Connor is a conservative justice already. He's even more conservative than Justice O'Connor.
Well, in your report, you go through the history of cases that Judge Alito was involved in, both on the bench as well as in the Justice Department. And you go in depth into some cases, the sheet metal workers union discrimination case that dates back to the 1970s, and also to the famous firefighters case in Cleveland, Ohio, where in both cases the judge really seemed to be at the extreme measure. At that time he was in the Justice Department, at the extreme end on affirmative action. Could you talk a little bit about specifically the positions that he took then?
Well, as a Justice Department lawyer, when he was recommending what positions the department should take, he was a clear opponent of affirmative action. That's why this whole issue of CAP is significant, in part because his views as a Justice Department lawyer are remarkably consistent with what he has done on the bench. He has been an opponent of affirmative action. So those memoranda from the Justice Department days indicate that. On the bench, he has been more conservative than conservative judges. So often, he has been a dissenter from opinions in which some of the conservative judges ruled in favor of civil rights claimants. And when he has ruled in favor of civil rights claimants, it's been in cases that have been slam dunks. It'd be almost impossible to go the other way. In fact, one of the significant things we point to is that in 15 years on the bench, he has only ruled on the merits for African-American plaintiffs in employment discrimination cases twice. That's a record that is significant. So, you know, you can't change that. You can't get around it. For whatever reason, he has indicated this leaning, which causes us legitimate concern about what he would do in the Supreme Court.
We're also joined by Jamin Raskin in our Washington studio. Your major concerns as you follow this hearing, but of course assess Samuel Alito's record before this week.
Well, the testimony was definitely not credible. I mean, to say that he was a member of the Concerni of Princeton in the 1980s and bragged about it in 1985 because of ROTC being off campus for a couple of years in the 70s, is just completely far-fetched. It's like saying someone is joining MoveOn.org in 2006 because they're opposed to the Republican impeachment effort against Bill Clinton in the 1990s. So the testimony did not add up, and he was a tense and nervous witness in talking about all of those things. But I would echo Ted's sentiment here that it, in a certain sense, it's kind of a sideshow. Our position on this kind of structuring in order to determine his views would be that this is kind of guilt by association. Now, of course, the Bush administration thinks that this is enough to declare people terrorists because they're members of groups, even if they don't adhere to everything that the group does, even if they don't know, what all of the ideological planks are. But from our perspective, I think that it would be enough just to look at the public record, that is, what do the cases say? And if you don't think that this is a judge interested in overturning Roe versus Wade based on his opinion in the Casey decision that started in the Third Circuit or based on his statements in Department of Justice briefs, you're too innocent to be let out of the house by yourself. I mean, it's very clear that he thinks Roe versus Wade is not anchored in the text, the history, the structure of the Constitution. And he also, I was extremely disturbed by his answers to Senator Specter's questioning yesterday about a series of cases where the Rehnquist Court has been dismantling federal statutes, like parts of the Violence Against Women Act, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the Gun-Free School Zones Act. You know, the Rehnquist Court is perhaps the most activist court in American history in terms of dismantling acts of Congress. And in questioning Alito directly about that, Alito essentially took the position that the Supreme Court's test about congruence and proportionality got it right in terms of what congressional powers under the 14th Amendment are. And so that was extremely sobering and disappointing as well. But in truth, we know exactly why Alito is there. This is the Federalist Society dream candidate for the Supreme Court. They've dressed him up for the confirmation hearings, but he is a right-wing ideologue in black robes.
We want to turn now to the issue of abortion. In 1985, Alito wrote in a federal job application that he personally believes, quote, the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion. On Tuesday, during the first day of questioning, he declined to say whether he still believes this, but he vowed to go into any case involving abortion with a, quote, open mind. On Wednesday, however, Alito refused to state that Roe v. Wade was the settled law of the land, a statement that was made by John Roberts 4 months ago during his confirmation hearings to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. This is Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois questioning Samuel Alito on Wednesday.
Do you believe it is the settled law of the land?
Roe v. Wade is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. It was decided in 1973, so it's been on the books for a long time. It has been challenged on a number of occasions, and I discussed those yesterday, and it is my and the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the decision, sometimes on the merits, sometimes in Casey, based on stare decisis. And I think that when a decision is challenged and it is reaffirmed, that strengthens its value as stare decisis for at least two reasons. First of all, the more often a decision is reaffirmed, the more people tend to rely on it. And secondly, I think stare decisis reflects the view that there is wisdom embedded in decisions that have been made by prior justices who take the same oath and are scholars and are conscientious. And when they examine a question and they reach a conclusion, I think that's entitled to considerable respect. And of course, the more times that happens, the more respect the decision is entitled to, and that's my view of that. So it's a very important precedent. That
is it the settled law of the land?
It is a precedent. If settled means that it can't be reexamined, then that's one thing. If settled means that it is a precedent that is entitled to respect as stare decisis, and all of the factors that I've mentioned come into play, including the reaffirmation and all of that, then it is a precedent that is protected, entitled to respect under the doctrine of stare decisis in that way.
Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito responding to questions from Senator Richard Durbin. Jamin Raskin, your response.
Well, the whole reason why the right wing turned on Harriet Myers was precisely because they didn't think that she was trustworthy on the abortion question and had said things kind of on both sides of the issues. Both sides of the issue over the years. And the mantra on the right has been no more suitors, that is, no more appointees like David Souter, who was named to the court by Bush's father, who might end up doing the wrong thing. There was a lot of phony baloney yesterday about the Democrats imposing an abortion litmus test. The litmus test, of course, comes from the right wing, which sacked Harriet Myers precisely because she was not a dependable vote against abortion. Everything in this nominee's record suggests that Alito would be someone moving very quickly on the court, along with Scalia and Thomas, to topple Roe versus Wade. And, you know, the Concerned Alumni of Princeton group also used to talk about abortion as well as affirmative action and South Africa divestment and all of these things. So someone who feels very comfortable in that ideological milieu, which is the same reason he's a member of the Federalist Society.
Ted Shaw, Judge Alito did say that he believed that one person, one vote was settled law in the country. But you also have some concerns about his record on voting rights issues. Could you talk about that?
Yes. Well, first, he did say at the hearing that one person, one vote was settled law because he had run into some trouble on that issue. In fact, in the 1980s, he had indicated that he believed that one person, one vote was problematic. The decision that gave us one person, one vote was problematic. In voting rights, he's had limited opportunity to rule in voting rights cases. One of the cases in the Third Circuit had to do with a challenge to at-large election schemes, which have often been used to subordinate minority voters' opportunity to elect representatives of choice. And in the case he ruled upon, he said that the at-large scheme should not be struck down. So it's indicated again that he parses very narrowly, and this is somebody who is really concerned about interpreting civil rights laws in the most stingy way, whether it's the Voting Rights Act, whether it's in the employment discrimination laws. His interpretations have been the most cramped, narrow readings, which, again, indicate what his thinking is, what his leanings are. And he does not believe in a vigorous interpretation, from what his record indicates, of civil rights laws.
I wanted to turn to another issue discussed day three of the hearings on Wednesday, citation of foreign law. This is Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn.
And I was interested in Senator Kyle asked you yesterday about foreign law. It's something that is extremely disturbing to a lot of Americans, that many on the Supreme Court today will reference or pick and choose the foreign law that they want to use to help them make a decision to interpret our Constitution, where in fact the oath of office mentions no foreign law. Matter of fact, it says the obligation is to use the United States law, the Constitution, and the treaties, and that's exactly what Article 3, Section 2 says. And so there's no reference at all to foreign law in terms of your obligations or your responsibility, and matter of fact, the absence of it would say that maybe this ought to be what we use, and the codified law of the Congress and the treaties rather than foreign law. So the question I have for you, and I couldn't get Judge Roberts to answer it because of the conflict that might occur afterwards, but I have the feeling that the vast majority of Americans don't think it is proper for the Supreme Court to use foreign law. And I personally believe that that's an indication of not good behavior by a justice, whether it be a justice at an appellate division or a magistrate or a Supreme Court justice. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that comment.
Well, I don't think that we should look to foreign law to interpret our own Constitution. I agree with you that the laws of the United States consist of the Constitution and treaties and laws, and I would add regulations that are promulgated in accordance with law. And I don't think that it's appropriate or useful to look to foreign law in interpreting the provisions of our Constitution. I think the framers would be stunned by the idea that the Bill of Rights is to be interpreted by taking a poll of the countries of the world. The purpose of the Bill of Rights was to give Americans rights that were recognized practically nowhere else in the world at the time. The framers did not want Americans to have the rights of people in France or the rights of people in Russia or any of the other countries on the continent of Europe at the time. They wanted them to have the rights of Americans, and I think we should interpret our Constitution. We should interpret our Constitution. I don't think it's appropriate to look to foreign law. I also don't think that it's. I think that it presents a host of practical problems that have been pointed out. You have to decide which countries you're going to survey, and then it's often difficult to understand exactly what you are to make of foreign court decisions. All countries don't set up their court systems the same way. Foreign courts may have greater authority than the courts of the United States. They may be given a policymaking role, and therefore it would be more appropriate for them to weigh in on policy issues. When our Constitution was being debated, there was a serious proposal to have members of the judiciary sit on a council of revision where they would have a policymaking role before legislation was passed, and other countries can set up their judiciary in that way. So you'd have to understand the jurisdiction and the authority of the foreign courts. And then sometimes it's misleading to look to just one narrow provision of foreign law without considering the larger body of law in which it's located. If you focus too narrowly on that, you may distort the big picture. So for all those reasons, I just don't think that's a useful thing to do.
It actually undermines democracy because you get to pick and choose. And the people of this country don't get to pick and choose that law. It's people from a different country. So it actually is a violation of the Constitution. And it, to me, very strongly and adamantly feel that it violates the good behavior, which is mentioned as part of the qualifications and the maintenance of that position.
Republican Senator Coburn questioning the Supreme Court nominee, Samuel Alito. We'll get response from the Director Counsel and President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Ted Shaw, when we return. We'll continue with Jamin Raskin of American University, and we'll be joined by Earth Justice to talk about Samuel Alito, the environment and public health. Stay with us.
If your man get buzzed and know, won't you have your fun? Let's come on back to fried fun, mama, and bail us all night long. I got women in Big Bub, clean on into Tennessee. Got women's in Vicksburg, clean on into Tennessee. But my fried point right now hops all over me. I ain't got to stay no color, but a front teeth crown we go.
Robert Johnson, Traveling Riverside Blues. It was announced this week that the legendary blues singer, who died in 1938, will receive a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award next month. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, low-power FM, community and college radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375 Link TV. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, linking to the reports of our guests. Among them, the report on the nomination of Judge Samuel A. Alito Jr. to the Supreme Court of the United States, that is written by the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Ted Shaw is the Director, Counsel, and President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. He's with us in our Firehouse studio. Juan?
Well, before the break, Ted Shaw, we heard an exchange with Judge Alito over his views on the Constitution and the relevance of foreign law. You were reacting quite in an animated fashion as you listened to his remarks. Your views?
Well, let me first say that in a few cases in recent years, some justices on the courts have looked to international law to supplement their views and their opinions. But their opinions have been written based upon interpretations of the Constitution and American law. And to the extent that they've cited foreign law, they've cited to say we are either acting consistently or inconsistently with the rest of the world. So, for example, there was a case before the Supreme Court a couple of terms ago involving the application of the death penalty to children, to minors. And we in the United States were out of step with the rest of the world and are out of step with the rest of the world on the death penalty, but particularly with respect to children, almost nobody in the rest of the world executed minors. Now, they were interpreting the Constitution first and last, but they noted that. The United States also signs international laws and treaties, and part of what is in the oath is to uphold the laws and the treaties signed by the United States. The United States practices exceptionalism with respect to many of these treaties. In other words, the United States may sign a treaty, but then it has no real effect here within the United States. So we don't really bring the concept of human rights home to the United States. So I was reacting because, in part, what the senator was suggesting was that even citing foreign law or international law may be an impeachable defense, offense rather. He didn't use the word impeachable. But when he talked about good behavior, that appears to be what he was talking about when he said, you know, maintaining good behavior is written into the Constitution on the part of judges. So this is such an extreme view, and it's also a distortion of what justices and others are doing when they cite or look to international law. It's not that it trumps American law, but it's a kind of a check to see if we are out of step with the rest of the world in a way that does not replace the interpretation of the Constitution, which is their primary responsibility.
Judge Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court has also raised concerns among environmentalists. Greenpeace, the National Environmental Trust, Earth Justice, Friends of the Earth, Sierra Club have all publicly opposed Alito's confirmation. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California asked Alito about his rulings in key environmental cases.
The Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. And it included a provision permitting citizens or citizen groups to bring lawsuits for violation of the act. In Public Interest Research Group of New Jersey versus Magnesium Electron, a citizens' environmental group sued a chemical manufacturer under the Clean Water Act for polluting a river used by members of the group. The trial court found that the defendant committed 150 Clean Water Act violations. On appeal, you were the decisive vote in a 2-1 decision overturning the trial court's decision, even though it was undisputed that the defendant committed the 150 violations of the Clean Water Act. Your decision, as I understand it, was based upon your conclusion that the environmental group did not have standing to sue under the Clean Water Act, because even though members of the environmental group had stopped using the river due to the pollution, they did not prove any injury to the environment. The decision, if broadly applied, would have gutted the citizen lawsuit provision of the Clean Water Act. Now, 3 years later, in Friends of the Earth v. Laidlaw, the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, rejected this reasoning and held that a citizen only needed to show that he or she was harmed by the Clean Water Act violation and didn't need to prove a broader injury to the environment. So you see where the concern comes with respect to overthrowing something on a technicality that can have enormous implications. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's decision in Friends of the Earth v. Laidlaw?
Well, it's a precedent of the court, and I have respect for it. And as you mentioned, and it's governed by stare decisis. And as you mentioned, it was decided after the decision of my court in the Magnesium Electron case. And I haven't gone back and thought about the question of whether Laidlaw creates doubt about the soundness of the decision in Magnesium Electron. If it does, then it does. And if the issue were to come up again before the Third Circuit, for example, and I sat on the issue, then I would follow Supreme Court precedent if I concluded that it was in conflict with the decision of a prior Court of Appeals decision. We have our jurisdiction under the Constitution is limited to cases and controversies. The Supreme Court has said That means you have to have a plaintiff who has suffered injury in fact. And although there was a disagreement on the panel about the procedure we should use going forward, everybody on the panel agreed, Judge Roth and I, who were in the majority, and Judge Lewis, who dissented on a procedural point that I'll get to, that the plaintiffs in that case had not even alleged personal injury. They alleged that they enjoyed the Delaware River in a variety of ways. As I recall, they walked along the canal path, they ate fish from the river, they drank water from the river, but there was no evidence that the discharges into a creek some distance upstream from the river had had any effect whatsoever on the river, and therefore there was nothing to support a claim that they were personally injured by the discharges of this plant.
That was Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito answering questions from Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. We're now joined by Glenn Sugamelli, a senior legislative counsel in Earth Justice's Policy and Legislative Program. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Your main concerns about the nomination of Judge Alito?
They include the exchange that you just heard. One of the major cases that we focused on in his record in deciding for the first time since Robert Bork to oppose a Supreme Court nominee. That's true for Earth Justice. It's true for Sierra Club. It's true for the other environmental groups that have joined us. This is an unusual step we've taken, and we've only taken it after looking at his record in detail. www.earthjustice.org has a lot more details, but that exchange was very illuminating. You saw that even now, Judge Alito doesn't get it. He's refusing to admit that the Laidlaw Supreme Court case essentially overturned his decision. He's only agreeing that as a Third Circuit judge, he would follow it if it was inconsistent with his previous decision. He's not saying what he would do on the Supreme Court and whether he agrees with the Laidlaw decision, which he was asked and refused to answer, or whether he would overturn it. So it is an example of interpreting the Constitution in a way that prevents Congress from allowing people to go to court to enforce the law. He also has an extreme view, which he was also asked about by Senator Feinstein the day before, on the interpretation of the Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. That's the basis for almost all federal environmental laws, as well as civil rights laws, labor laws, consumer laws. And he wrote a very lonely dissent, which he had very misleading testimony about, saying that a Reagan-signed law to ban possession of machine guns was beyond Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause. He presented that as if it was a clear application of a Supreme Court precedent, ignored and the fact that several other circuit courts from around the country had reached a different result before him, that the majority did in his case. The Supreme Court refused to review all the 8 times those type of decisions. The only time a single court agreed with him, the Supreme Court immediately wiped it off the books, vacated it, remanded it, said take another look at it. So he's not even suggesting, in light of all that history, that maybe his opinion was wrong in Rybar. He's still sticking by it, and he still has this extreme view of extremely limited congressional power, which is a real threat. Right now, the Supreme Court, by the end of June, will decide 2 cases under the Clean Water Act where industry is claiming that long-standing protections for the vast majority of our streams and wetlands are unconstitutional. It should be wiped off the books. And that's a real issue.
And your review of the judge's record also indicates he provided a major vote for, a decisive vote for W.R. Grace in a battle with the EPA over drinking water emergency cleanup. Could you talk about that?
That's right. I mean, it might be a don't drink the water message if he does get confirmed to the court. This was a case where the EPA took emergency action under the Safe Drinking Water Act to protect the drinking water supply of Lansing, Michigan, 160,000 people, from a toxic spill from W.R. Grace. And he provided the decisive vote in a 2-1 decision to overturn that agency action, even though the dissenting judge stressed how decisions from his court, decisions from other courts, all required the court to be extremely deferential to EPA, to basically uphold EPA if at all possible. He's done that in another case where he overturned a multimillion-dollar fine imposed by EPA against a polluter. So he has an overall record that falls into three categories: straight environmental cases, but also access to courts, reading the Constitution to not allow Congress to allow citizens to effectively enforce the environmental and other laws, and also not to allow Congress to actually pass laws, including laws that have been in effect for a long time.
I wanted to turn back to Jamin Raskin, professor of constitutional law at American University, author of Overruling Democracy, Supreme Court versus the American People, and ask about a question that kept coming up yesterday around the issue of Vanguard. Judge Alito's participation in a 2002 federal case involving the mutual fund company Vanguard, in which he holds over $300,000 in personal investments. At the time, the case received little attention, but now it's playing a central role in the confirmation hearings. A widow sued Vanguard, claiming she was entitled to money from a retirement fund belonging to her deceased husband. Alito agreed to hear the case, even though in 1990, in another confirmation hearing of his, he pledged to the Senate that he would recuse himself, because of his own personal investments, of any case involving Vanguard. Democrats kept pressing the issue about Alito's integrity because he did not recuse himself in this case, while Republicans have downplayed the issue. Your response?
Well, the judicial canons are pretty vague and open-ended with respect to recusal, and I think that's something that we need to clean up to give them more precision and direction. But this case was clear because he appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and pledged that he would recuse himself from any cases having to do with Vanguard. And then it was typical of this nominee's testimony over the last few days. They sent forth a bunch of different alibis and explanations, including, well, he said that just initially he would do it. That is, for some unspecified period of years, he would recuse. That was one argument. Then another argument was, well, there was no chance that he would stand to benefit from the outcome in this particular case. And so there's kind of a cloud of obfuscation that has surrounded it. But in fact, he made a promise and a pledge, which he retreated from precisely because he thought it, you know, nobody was watching, perhaps, or it would be no big deal. But what's interesting to me is the way in which this is all about spin. It's a struggle between content and form. If people actually read his opinions in the civil rights cases, in the sex discrimination cases, in the Fourth Amendment cases, which we haven't talked about, in one of those he found that a 15-year-old who was shot in the back of the head and killed by a police officer had not been seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And if he had been seized, he said it was perfectly reasonable. All of these things, you know, add up to a very clear picture and a very clear pattern, and yet it's so hard to communicate that to people through all of the Machiavellian spin of the Republican media masters here. And what they're putting up instead is this image of the immigrant son and so on.
Ted Cho, we only have 30 seconds. You're going to be testifying tomorrow. What do you expect will happen? Do you think Samuel Alito will be confirmed?
Well, you know, opposing a Supreme Court nominee is always an uphill fight, but particularly when the party in control of the White House also controls the Senate. So if I were a betting man, I still would not bet against confirmation. At the same time, this is a vigorous fight, and you just don't know what's going to happen until it happens. Everybody's thinking about whether there's going to be a filibuster and what the Gang of 14 will do and all of that. All I know is that we have to fight these nominees one at a time if they are as bad as we think this one is. And if you fight, you might have a chance of winning. If you don't fight, you'll never win.
Ted Cho, I want to thank you very much for being with us. President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Also, Jamin Raskin, professor of constitutional law at American University, and Glenn Sugamelli of Earth Justice. Thanks for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Bershew, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, and Nagara Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.